Okay, so today, of course, once again, we're going to finish up with chapters 32 and 33. Now, of course, next week there's the Vyasa Puja for Dave and Rita Swami in the theatre.
So, no, it's
the Shard of all, I meant, yeah, that's right. Oh, okay. So, I don't think we'll be able to do cars as well. How many people? Who will be going today when we're just from his? I imagine, you know, a lot of people. So I don't think there'll be class next week as a result of that. So I guess what that means is that we'll see how we go today. But if we finish today, it would mean that in 2 weeks' time we would have an exam. So on the 20th is Holiness Day, the Rita Swami's Vyasa Puja. And so it'll be the 27th. We'll be having an exam. All right, well. Yeah. Chapter 32. Now, in this chapter, the Lord describes the Grihamedi, the person who enjoys material benefits by performing religious rituals. For these persons are bereft of Krishna consciousness, they're not interested in devotional service to the Lord. They get elevated to the heavenly planets, but they have to come back. And of course, at the time of dissolution, as we've heard, the heavenly planets are all destroyed. Now, there are persons who perform prescribed duties for the gratification of the Supreme Lord. They attain the kingdom of God. There is a description of worshippers of Hiranyagarbha and yogis who go to Brahmaloka until the time of dissolution, after which they enter the kingdom of God along with Brahma. Brahma and other great sages attain the first Purush Mahavishnu, but have to take birth again in the next creation because of their independent nature. So it says they attain the kingdom of God, means they enter into Mahavishnu. That's what it means by attaining the kingdom of God.
As in the end of Mahavishnu. As in Brahma and those inhabitants of the...
Yep, all of those who have gone to the heavenly planets up to Brahmaloka.
Then they come back to the next creation.
Yep, so we'll have a little bit of discussion on that. The variations in that. Now, some very strong words here by Kapila Muni, that persons are only interested in dharma, artha, and karma, and not moksha, are compared to stool eating hogs. They go to Pitchaloka. and they come down to earth again to take birth in their own families. Lord Kapila advises his mother to take shelter of the Supreme Lord with devotion. So he's not really recommending any of those paths. Taking to devotional service. Now, by devotional service, transcendental knowledge and detachment develop. It describes the equipoise vision of the devotees. In comparison to those who speculate with their imperfect senses on the absolute truth, only the person who's engaged in devotional service, of course, come to realize the absolute truth or come to Krishna consciousness, and thus become absorbed in full samadhi. And in order to help people to come to Krishna consciousness, there are different processes described, but they're all meant to elevate people to Krishna consciousness. And then there's a discussion on how the instructions by Lord Kapila are not meant to be given to persons who are too greedy, too attached to family life, non-devotees, and those who are envious of the Lord. Another very interesting discussion that we can have there. Rather, they should be given to the faithful devotee who is respectful to the spiritual master. Non-envious, friendly to all kinds of living entities, eager to render service with faith and sincerity, and who have taken the Supreme Personality of Godhead to be more dear than anything else. Anyone who once meditates upon Lord Kapila with faith and affection, who hears and chants about him, surely goes back home, back to Godhead. So that must be all of us. So, let's have a look at So, in the beginning, as described, verses 1 to 4 give a description of the Griha Maiti. They perform religious rituals really for their own personal benefits, not so much for the benefit of the Lord, not so much for the pleasure of the Lord. We quite often get people who, because I'm near that jagi room, which is near the entrance of the door, so many people come to the temple after the Lord's doors are closed, and because they've just come along at a certain time to get a blessing for something, and they'll ask, can you open up the doors and just let me go and get some blessings. And you say, oh no, the Lord's asleep now. They go, oh, but just, I'll just be 5 minutes, I just want to see them. I sometimes explain to them that, it's not that the Lord is supposed to arrange his life around theirs, but, they're meant to fit in with the Lord's agenda. It's like, when he's taking rest, they should fit in with his agenda rather than he should, fit in with their. But actually, in that you sort of detect that whole mentality, which is like this, that people actually want God to just slot into, certain spaces in their life they've allocated for God, for their convenience, for their benefit, like that. Even when they come to a Hare Krishna temple. So, they're not really interested in Krishna consciousness. The people, and that does include many people who worship Lord Ram, we were discussing the other day how some people say that Lord Ram ate meat, and therefore they eat meat. You know, that's the sort of thing. They're really just worshipping God or accepting His authority only where it suits their particular wants. And where it doesn't suit their particular wants, they really just have no interest, or they'll just reject that outright. And therefore, Rupa Goswami says that persons who worship the Lord without reference to the Vedas, the four Vedas, the Upanishads, the Puranas, the Mahabharats, the Ramayana, the Pancharatri, Pancharatra, if they're worshipping the Lord without reference to all of those scriptures, it simply creates a disturbance, nothing more. It's a disturbance to the Lord, it's a disturbance to society, and it's just a disturbance to the devotees. Now, there are persons who are very devoted to the forefathers and the demigods. Such persons have to return to this material world. They don't attain liberation. In verse 4, it describes all the planets of the materialistic persons, including all the heavenly planets such as the moon, are vanquished at the time when the Supreme Lord Hari goes to bed of his bed of serpents, which is known as Anantasesha. So we read that earlier in the third canto. All the heavenly planets, such as the moon, vanquished in time. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, goes to his bed of serpents, which is known as Anantasesha. As far as I understand, that's Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Well, it can refer to both in the sense that there are partial devastation, but the universe remains intact, but all the planets are submerged. You know, and then there's a devastation of all the universes. So Prabhupada mentions there are two kinds of dissolutions in the purport. One takes place at the end of Brahma's life. At that time, all the planetary systems are dissolved in water and enter into the body of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. He lies on the Garbhodaka ocean on the bed of serpents called Sesha. So that's at the end of Brahma's life. Another occurs at the end of his day. Lower planetary system. When Lord Brahma rises after his night, these lower planetary systems are again created. Now, from memory, we discussed that according to the Acharyas, on the last day, this particular day is called a Padmakalpa, because the Brahma emerges from the lotus flower which emanates from the body of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, and that happens in a Padmakalpa, not in every kalpa. And that is generally the beginning of creation, the last day of Brahma's 50th year, 49th year of life, and the first day of his 50th year.
That's very
which is this day, that's what is today, Brahma's day. Brahma's birthday, it's, you know, it's a celebration, 50 years. So, you know, this is the first day at the beginning of Brahma's 50, you know, second half of his life, the next 50 years. So 50 years have passed. So 50 years have passed, and this is the first day of Brahma's next 50 years, as also Padma Kalpa. So in those Padma Kalpas, we have the emanation of the lotus flower.
After the first 50 years, there's emanation, or?
Yeah.
Isn't Brahma
already there, or? They've all entered into the body of Gavilaksha Vishnu.
Oh, okay, and after 50 years.
Well, you know, Brahma, every night, Brahma goes to sleep, of course. And not all of the planetary systems are dissolved.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a few, which are called the Padma Kalpa, where the devastation is slightly different, and it's something like the first day of creation again, where the lotus flower, you know, that's described in the Canto. So there, you know, there are different types of disillusions. Prabhupada says in the first case, at the end of Brahma's life, at that time all the planetary systems, including the heavenly system, dissolved in water and enter into the body of Gavilaksha Vishnu. That scenario we read about earlier in the third canto, it appeared to be like the end of Brahma's life, although it was actually just the end of his first 50 years of life. And therefore, you know, all the planetary systems actually were dissolved in water. We read about that.
Is that when the earth was in the ocean?
The earth was in the ocean. The different circumstances.
That was Varaha incarnation.
Yeah, Varaha incarnation. Therefore, this first kalpa is also called the Sveta Varaha kalpa. Sometimes called Sveta Varaha kalpa, Padma kalpa. They're one and the same. Because it's the first day of the second half of Brahma's life. And therefore, the scenario was much like the first day of Brahma's life. But usually at the end of Brahma's night, the dissolution is not so complete. Just the lower planetary systems will dissolve.
So this Padmakalpa dissolution takes place twice? That is one in the first day of Brahma?
The first day of Brahma.
And then again tonight.
The last night of his 50th year and the first day of the second 50th year. Yeah.
Very first day.
He's a little baby. But, you know, Brahma, he's a baby. Brahma's born, you know, as Brahma. He's one day old.
So, and last night was 58.
Yeah.
He'll be the same size brother, or he'll also grow?
He didn't come out with four dummies in his mouth, if that's what we asked him. No, he he was Brahma, you know, had on Brahma. From the beginning. So we're describing here that this verse is describing when You know, all the materialistic persons, including the heavenly planets, are vanquished. When Hari goes onto his bed of serpents, which is known as Anantha Sesha, everyone's entering into Gavadaksha Vishnu. And this is specifically referring not to the partial devastation at the end of Brahma's night, but the more complete devastation at the end of his life. But as I just described, that scenario at the end of his life sometimes happens on those other days of the Padma Kali. Yeah. So,
at the end of Brahma's life, does Gavadaksha Vishnu still stay the way he is, or does he go back to Mahavishnu?
Ultimately, at the end of Brahma's life, so then the reference is that Brahma Samhita, the Brahma remains for the duration of one breath in Mahavishnu.
Yeah.
So that means that they're all wound up within Mahavishnu universe. So therefore, Gavadaksha Vishnu enters within Mahavishnu. So then it describes the Krishna conscious persons. Lord Kapila has described devotional service to the Lord in previous chapters, and those persons who take the pure devotional service, they're not interested in their personal sense gratification. They may perform prescribed duties in order to come to Krishna consciousness or in order to satisfy the Lord in some way or another, but not for themselves. Now, so
Prabhu, then isn't it baffling?
What is baffling?
That people as high as Kadama Muni, who's so way, way above and so renounced, he still has material desire.
Kadama Muni is liberated.
Even at that stage, he has material desire.
Yes, there are different stages of liberation, but you know, through marriage, he was able to purify himself of that material desire.
That's true, but yeah, like we were reading just even in the last class we have, like then for men, the best chance is not to get attached to women and just go straight, and then you go in this lifetime. Otherwise, you are, it's an obstacle for you. And you are making it longer. We were talking about all that.
Yeah.
So, like now again, we are saying that no material. So I was just thinking back. So this is when we are finding, and I was thinking here we find so many sannyasis, consannyasis, right? At very young age, taking sannyasis. But then they are how are they managing? Where Kadama Muni of that level. He still had material desires. He wanted to marry.
Yeah, it's a very rare thing. It's not a usual thing for people to take sannyas at such an early age. Nor is it recommended. Nor did Prabhupada, you know, recommend it. Prabhupada made a few exceptions. With a few devotees who showed, you know, exceptional enthusiasm to spread Krishna consciousness, you know, he gave them, empowered them with his full mercy, and you know, for those who took that mercy, you know, they were very successful. It was quite incredible, you know, you know. What they, those that just accepted that mercy and never really strayed away. It was quite, you know, quite miraculous. You know, it's practically unheard of.
Yeah.
I mean, people like Saint Bhachara and Madhvacharya, you know, there are a few rare souls, but within ISKCON, actually there were many who did that. It's extremely rare, you have to understand. Therefore, it's not unusual that some of them didn't quite make it, but there's no loss for them that they made such a sacrifice or they took a risk. You know, every soldier who goes to battle takes a risk, and some die. There's nothing unglorious about it. You know, and any war, it's always the few that get home that's the unusual thing. And you know, you expect to lose a huge amount of people. So that happened. But you know, it was a period in ISKCON's life, as we discussed previously, where
it was required at that time.
Yeah. But it's not required now.
But then in Bhagavatam, we're just saying that men, is better you don't get attached to women. It is really
that's
the
right.
way they're describing it, that woman is your downfall, and they're as if it is recommending that use your time just to be totally dedicated to Krishna.
Yeah, well,
whereas
you know,
people
it's not women so much as the desire for sex life. That's the real problem.
Yeah, that's
you know,
okay.
The Vedas don't really have a grudge against.
Sorry, can I take one of the whiteboards?
Yeah. Thank you. The Vedas don't have a grudge against women. The Vedas are saying that you know, don't follow the path of sex life because, you know, that's going to keep you in the material world.
Yeah.
And really, you're better off to just go straight back to Godhead right now. And if you want to do that in the safest, quickest way, forget about sex and just go back to God. That's what the Vedas are saying.
Yep.
Now, for those who say, oh, okay, yes, gee, I forgot all about that, you know, I'm in the wrong place and something. And then they're saying, now, if you've made that decision, don't associate with, you know, the opposite sex because you'll find that that sex desire will, you know, very quickly, bounce back in your heart. So therefore, don't associate. So it's not a grudge against women, it's just saying, you know, that, for instance, it's a very natural thing. If someone becomes diseased, this is an example Prabhupada gives. Someone goes to, some place, they catch some particular disease, and then they go to the hospital and they're in the convalescent stage. Now, in the convalescent stage, you are advised very strongly to not reassociate yourself with those circumstances. Because you're still in a highly susceptible state to relapse. You're a doctor, right? So, you know, that's all the Vedas are saying, that first of all, don't remain diseased. You're in a diseased condition. Material life is a diseased condition for the souls. It's an impure state, a contaminated state. Don't remain there, that's a place of suffering. Don't remain ill, you'll suffer, that's suffering. Be healthy, you know, healthy is coming through. If you decide, if you understand that, because most people take their disease position as normal, but the Vedas are saying it's actually not normal, you know, you actually got that. So then you decide, okay, yes, I've understood. I'm actually finally realised after so many millions of years, I'm not in a normal condition, I'm in a suffering condition, a disease condition, spiritually. Therefore, the Vedas say, but we don't want you to relapse. So don't associate, once again, with those factors that put you in this circumstance. Therefore, all the instructions should be taken in that understanding. Now, for one who, again, becomes very, very healthy, and who has taken proper precautions, then that person may actually, in order to help others in that disease condition, they may actually go there and help other people who are ill to get over that illness as they have done, but this time they're very strong, taking the right precautions. Those people can associate, and that we discuss therefore for those who are strongly, you know, fixed up in their preaching and their Krishna consciousness. They can associate as they please, always being somewhat cautious, but you know, the stricter association is for those who are in convalescence. So all of the instructions of the Vedas should be taken in that regard, in regard to association with women and sex life.
So does that mean that, so again, this is a dumb question, so does it mean Grihastha Ashram should just not, shouldn't be there?
No, Grihastha Ashram is very important because you know, it's you know, it's one of the prescriptions to become healthy again. So, for instance, again, you know, sometimes you know, if you have a particular illness, they will give you, they can sometimes give you small doses of that which made you ill as part of your treatment. It actually builds up an immunity within the body and makes you stronger. So if it's given in the right dose, that thing which made you ill will actually cure you. So the dosage, therefore, the Vedas give a dosage of association with women, which actually builds up an immunity against, you know, material attraction. So, and therefore, in Grihastha life, there are rules and regulations. If we say, oh, well, the, you know, the Vedas are saying I can associate with women, I'll just associate as much as I want, you know. So it's like, that's like the doctor says, you know, I'll give you a little pinch of this, you know, medicine, you know, but no more. And the patient says, oh, you know, if it's good for me, I'll just drink the whole bottle.
It's a little vaccination.
But, you know, you have to take the doses. The doses.
Sorry, Prabhu, you got diverted. I didn't mind man or woman, because even for women, the prescription there is in Bhagavatam that
they shouldn't get too attached to the man.
Yeah. Even for women, the writing. So I'm not saying man or woman in that sense, but the message we are getting from the Vedas is not to get entangled.
Yeah.
And that's what is being practiced in Pune and ISKCON. They are going out to colleges and preaching strongly, heavily to the youngsters. And they're trying to get them enrolled as brahmacharis. And then they're giving a lot of training from Bhagavatam about this life is sort of material enjoyment is such a waste of time.
Yeah, look, you know, Prabhupada followed Rupa Goswami's formula. And we read this in the Nectar Devotion. What did Prabhupada follow? What did Rupa Goswami say? Rupa Goswami says, somehow or another, you just get them to be attracted to Krishna. All the rules and regulations will follow later. And Prabhupada said he strongly implemented that Krishna consciousness philosophy, Rupa Goswami, in order to spread Krishna consciousness. And then Prabhupada, on speaking on that exact verse, then gave his example that he said, I went to Tompkins Square Park. We would chant from, you know, 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock for about 3 hours. They would dance, they would chant, and he would do that as often as he could. He said, I never introduced any rules and regulations. At all. He would just say, chant, dance, peace. That's actually the proper way to preach Krishna consciousness. in the beginning.
That's what they do in the beginning, at in the college. But once they get...
They give them two options. They give them the option...
No. First, they are given a strong option to become a total brahmachari.
Yeah.
Once they keep coming, taking prasadam and all that, then there's another thing in the temple to getting them to be enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get enrolled, they're given strong listening lectures from Bhagavatam about why they should be a brahmachari.
Yeah.
Then they say that if you cannot do this, okay, you can take the option of being a grahastha and still can follow Krishna consciousness.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have to be careful. They're not... This is done.
There is a regulator. I'm not saying there is a logic for this, because this is done by Radhanath Maharaj, who has a big vision.
Yeah.
So it is.
If it's being done properly, but you know, we then that's okay. But you know, if there's override Rupa Goswami's principle of just helping people to become attached to Krishna,
That they're doing it properly, and they're very careful.
Okay.
They're very careful to do it.
So you don't have a problem with it?
I don't have a problem, but it's not falling. I mean, I'm trying to understand here where Kadama, my whole question is.
Yes.
Now I do understand they're doing it really, really systematically and very carefully.
Yes.
But when we read from Bhagavatam and say that even Kadama, like we read just now, Kadama Muni also had mutual desire. So you said it's very, very rare, very, very difficult at that young age to become a sannyasi like that. Where Kadama Muni himself had mutual desire. That's where I can't understand. I know what they're doing in Pune seems very systematic, very logical. They're doing it very carefully. But on the other side, this is, I'm finding, people
the,
like Kadama
the
Muni
secret
have
is this, is that in the case of Kadama Muni, right, he had some material desires, not excessive, but there was certainly, you know, one there, which he couldn't get rid of. But therefore the Lord made certain arrangements. Therefore, problem solved. Similarly, if someone has material desires, then, as we say, there are prescriptions, and if things are properly prescribed, that this person has material desires, though, then the person, whether they have material desires or not, is not particularly important, because if the proper prescriptions are made, then you know they will be okay. So you know the difficulty is not having material desires. Everyone has material desires. The main thing is the prescription. What does Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that in the sixth chapter? Yes, it is impossible to control the mind and the senses, but it is possible by detachment and
suitable practice and detachment.
So therefore the Bhagavad Gita gives so many suitable practices. You know, a doctor gives suitable practices and medicines and diet like that. So you know, if that's there, the person has material desires, you know, it's like if someone goes to a hospital, they're going there because they're ill. The doctor's not like freaked out. Oh, this person's sick. You know, it's like, but the whole thing is, he's a doctor and he knows all the suitable So in ISKCON, that's, you know, we cure both the physical and the spiritual. That... What is that? I don't have a wife at the moment. So therefore in ISKCON, you know, the Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita is filled with the suitable practices. And we understand everyone's coming, they have some material desires, and therefore there are so many suitable practices. So it's not an alarming situation, it's not, you know, it's... just as a doctor goes to a hospital or goes to their clinic every day and they understand that today, you know, so many ill people will come in and I'll prescribe the suitable practice. It just becomes a daily business. So for a devotee as well, you know, we just implement the suitable practices. So, and that means that sometimes the suitable practice is someone takes sannyas, someone doesn't take sannyas. Someone becomes grihastha, someone doesn't. Someone goes straight into the ashram, someone doesn't. Someone remains in their job, someone gives up their job. You know, it is prescribed according, you know, accordingly. So, you know, there's no real difficulty there.
So can we say that as per their understanding and as per their circumstances, they will take up to whatever is suitable for them, even though it has been introduced to them in a systematic manner?
Yeah, it's better if the patient, you know, takes up exactly what the doctor prescribes. Where the patient adjusts the doctor's prescriptions is usually not recommended. That's what I said. The doctor says, you know, there's a little bit of this in this medicine that actually made you sick, but I'm giving you a small dose which other things that actually make you better. So it'll cure you. And the patient says, well, if it's going to cure, he gets home and thinks, oh, it's going to be cured. The doctor said it'll take a month. Well, you know, I want to be back. I want to be out in the football field in the day, so I'm going to drink the whole bottle. Oh, I've got a date with my girlfriend next Friday. I'm not going to miss that for work. So, you know, we don't adjust. And those who make rapid advancement in spiritual life, they take, you know, the instructions of Krishna like that. That Krishna gives an exact prescription and we follow it exactly as prescribed. That's the distinct difference between the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and practically every other religious or spiritual movement. Every other movement in this world practically adjusts the people who are spiritually, you know, ill. They adjust, and because the priests or the brahmanas or the gurus want to maintain their financial situation, their popularity, and so many different things, the facility, they allow them to adjust. But Prabhupada was different. Prabhupada would say that, you know, no, the principles are there. You take them or you go away as you please, but we will not change them. Now, as I said, that doesn't override the fact that in the beginning, you've at least got to attract people to come and take the medicine and the diet. That's there. And once they're attracted, and that, yes, then give them the medicine and the diet, but at least to get them into the hospital like that. You know, like in some places, you know, they have epidemics, and, you know, the first thing is just to get some relationship between the doctor and the people in that village or something. And they give them gifts, they do something. The people trust them, and then they'll say. So
I think my mother's concern is more that once they've been attracted and they've gone into the ashram for some training,
mm.
if there is so much positives given to brahmachari life,
mm.
That the brahmachari may not make the correct decision for what is best for him.
Yeah, well, that's a management. You know, that means whoever's managing the temple. The more they understand how Prabhupada did things, the more they have these Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Bhai Bhava, proper understanding of the books, so that, you know, people don't just, I read something in the, I know one quote, I know one statement of Prabhupada about Grihastha life and Brahmachari life, and, you know, therefore, you know, I'll make a whole program according to that one page I read. But we're hoping these classes means that you'll read all of Prabhupada's books and then you have a much, you know, broader understanding. So these are just management issues. Things go wrong because people, you know, are not properly understanding Prabhupada's books and therefore they're not properly giving the prescription. So, you know, they're management problems in different temples. And that's why these programs are so important. But you know, in temples where there perhaps may not actually be a certain facility, that, you know, there's no very senior devotees, that, you know, some countries, you know, the sannyasi came through, you know, one or two people took up Krishna consciousness, you know, they've hardly read anything and they open a little center and that's all anyone's got. So we can't, you know, blame them, at least they're doing something. But if a temple's established after some time, then more and more and more they should be fixed in Prabhupada's books and his lectures and gradually learn to do something. So, you know, a blind uncle is better than none. But here, you know, this temple's been here for, you know, since 1975, I think it is, yeah. We wouldn't expect, you know, wrong prescription. I mean, you know, I could spend the rest of the time.
That is under the management of Radhanath Maharaj, who's an expert in all this.
Therefore, it should be okay.
So, but I'm just
I can tell you some horror stories about, you know, when I was.
I'm trying to understand the two. I mean, it doesn't make sense in the two, but.
You're happy now? There's a lot. Let's take it this way. We've just given you a lot of information on that. First of all, digest that, and if you still got a problem next week, come back and see me. It's like this: take two aspirins. I'll see you.
I've been meditating over this for 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's all right. Take two aspirins. See me in the morning.
So it's to look at the broader picture rather than just attaching narrow-minded meanings to every word that is said, that's the main thing, having
a broad vision based upon a good, you know, understanding of, you know, Prabhupada's instructions.
There was one lecture of Prabhupada in which I heard he was saying, like, I'm not sure if I mentioned it last week, that Brahmana should come through all the four ashramas, or at least through Brahmachari and Sannyasi. Kshatriyas can just go to Vanaprastha.
No, they don't have to. means that the facility is there for them.
Mm-hmm. And Shudras is
there. So the facility is there for a Brahmana to take Sannyas after going through the various ashrams. That facility is not there in other Vanas.
Mm-hmm.
It's not saying they have to.
Yeah. For Shudras, it's like, it's just Kriyastha.
Yeah.
Just be. Whereas at
this
time,
that's
a Shudra. So.
Yeah. That's right. So, here we're discussing about Lord Gavadakshaya Vishnu, how everyone enters his body at the time of the dissolution of the universe. Now, in verse 8, it describes the worshippers of the Hiranyagarbha expansion of the personality of Godhead remaineth in this material world until the end of two Puradas, when Lord Brahma also dies. Now, in this purport, it describes the don't approach the Supreme Person of Godhead in Vaikuntha directly. You're not going back to Godhead in that sense. They remain within this universe on Satyaloka or other higher planets until the end of Brahma's life, then with Brahma they are elevated to the spiritual kingdom. Now let's take it first of all, the spiritual kingdom is referring to being within Gavadakshaya Vishnu, but let's take it that some of them may also actually go back to Godhead. So, so it describes here that the words Parasya Para Chintaptaha mean those who are fully Krishna conscious, such persons enter directly into the kingdom of God, the Vaikuntha planets, or if they are worshippers of the plenary portion Gavadakshaya Vishnu, then they remain within this universe until dissolution, and after that they enter. So here's describing the two types of people who can go back to Godhead. Those who worship the Supreme Lord directly, they go back to Godhead. They don't necessarily enter within Gavaraksha Vishnu. They just go back to Godhead. when they leave the body, they go back to Godhead. Others, enter within the worshippers of plenary portion Gavaraksha Vishnu. They actually enter, they remain within the universe right to the end. And then in dissolution, they may go back into the Vaikuntha the planets.
Okay, so without going to Gavaraksha Vishnu, at the end of dissolution?
Some go directly back to Godhead without entering Gavaraksha Vishnu, and some go back to Godhead after entering Gavaraksha Vishnu, and some enter Gavaraksha Vishnu and don't go back to Godhead. Therefore, it describes in the next verse that after experiencing the inhabitable time of the three modes of material nature known as two paradas, that's the 250-year periods of Brahma's life, Lord Brahma closes the material universe, which is covered by layers of earth, air, etc., and goes back to Godhead. So here it says Lord Brahma goes back to Godhead.
Which verse is it?
This is verse number 9. So the material world finally dissolves. So when, after ruling over the material universe under the influence of the time element, Lord Brahma desires to dissolve it and enter into the kingdom of God, others then enter within him. In the next verse, the yogis who become detached from the material world by practice of breathing exercises, etc., they reach the planet of Brahma. When they give up their bodies, they enter into the body of Lord Brahma. When Brahma is liberated and goes to the Supreme Lord, the yogis also enter into the kingdom of God. Alright, so, yeah?
You know how it says the destination of those who worship, the worshippers of Hiranyagarbha?
Mm.
So did you say, how do you actually define Hiranyagarbha here? What is it referring to?
Hiranyagarbha?
Yeah.
Gavaraksha Vishnu.
So,
let me see, the worshipping Hiranyagarbha. Hiranyagarbha, okay. Hiranyagarbha is mentioned in previously. Worshippers of the Hiranyagarbha expansion of personality of Godhead. So that was mentioned in verse 8.
Could that refer to, in one sense, the universal form of the Lord? Because...
Yeah, it can. It can, you know, Hiranyagarbha can have different meanings. It can refer to Lord Brahma. It can refer to the universal form. And it can refer to Gavaraksha Vishnu, who is the super soul of Lord Brahma and the universal form.
So it's not Lord Vishnu, like it's not the Lord's incarnation of Mahavishnu that it's referring to here?
Not Mahavishnu,
but Gavaraksha Vishnu.
Gavaraksha Vishnu.
But then,
and some may have different understandings of Gavaraksha Vishnu. They may only understand Gavaraksha Vishnu's aspect as the universal form. They may only understand, you know, that Lord Brahma, in one sense, one form of Lord Brahma is as the universal form, you know. Yeah, and you know, the and then they may understand that if they understand fully, they understand that Gavaraksha Vishnu is in fact the super soul of Lord Brahma and the universal form.
Then it's not talking about those who actually are in Dasyaras, right? It's not referring to those
worshippers. No.
No.
No, these are Santa Bhaktas.
Santa Bhaktas are yogis. Yeah. I thought you're referring to yogis.
Yeah. Right. Yogis can be Santa Bhaktas. They can attain liberation as Santa Bhaktas. You know, therefore, you know, if they elevate above yogis, they become Santa Bhaktas. Mm. Or, you know, if they remain yogis without, you know, sufficient quality of bhakti, then they remain, you know,
then they come
yogis.
Back. Then
yeah.
That's those are the people who come back.
Yeah.
Take birth again.
Yeah.
You just said that even Lord Brahma comes back, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So we're going to get to that. So, is that?
Just one question coming out of this one. But then the next verse says that
verse,
the yogis then merge into Lord Brahma's body.
Yes.
But then isn't Lord Brahma's body made of just intelligence? So then does that mean that they all become purified to the level that they actually are equivalent to Lord Brahma and then they merge in his body? Or?
They enter into Brahma, you know, in a subtle body, you know, in their subtle body.
But Lord Brahma doesn't have a gross body, does he?
Lord Brahma exists in three different forms. You know, as the expansion of the universe, as the sum total of all living entities, and as the four-headed Brahma that we sometimes see that rides the swan and comes up, visits Krishna and sits in the court of heaven.
Expansion of the universe, sum total of all living entities.
Sum total of all living entities, you know, like the expansion of the universe in its subtle form, some extent, and in his four-headed form, you know, on Satchaloka. So, you know, what's his wife's name? Is Sarasvati? Yes. Anyone else? Sarasvati. You know, Sarasvati, when she's with Lord Brahma, you know, she's... you know, she can embrace him in that form. He has that form, which is, you know, as you and I can, you know, relate to each other. So she's not, she doesn't, you know, look in the pillow beside her and see the whole universe, you know. Time for dinner, she's wondering, you know, where to put the spoon. So, you know.
So, but then, what's the expansion of universal form? What does that form of Lord Brahma look like?
In essence, it's the universal form. It's all of the universe in one is actually contained within Brahma's form. You know, that is one form of Brahma. You know, that universal form is an aspect of Brahma. You know, it's you know, in the same way that we can relate to, you know, our body and mind and aura and, you know, everything, you know, as a, even though the soul is situated, you know, 1/10,000th the size of the tip of the head. You know, in comparison to the body, the soul is practically, you know, so minute. But, you know, literally we have full awareness of the entire body, you know, as our body. So Brahma has that sort of awareness or consciousness of the universe as like an expansion of his form. You know, that, you know, therefore, you know, one of the qualities that demigods like Brahma have is that they're somewhat all-knowing. You know, describes that, you know, living entities can have qualities, you know, so many qualities, 87% or something, And, you know, for personalities like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, they're also described as somewhat omniscient. Not to the same extent as Lord Vishnu, but Lord Brahma is fully aware of everything within the universe because it's like his body, another form of his body, an expansion of it. And the same, you know, we're like, although if you imagine the size of the soul within our heart, and yet we're fully aware of every part of our body, you know. You would think something so small, you know, could not be aware of something that's, million, you know, times its own size distance. But we do that every day. So Brahma's, you know, situation within the universe is like that. He has that sort of consciousness of the universe like it's an extension of his body.
So then how is it different from the universal form of the Lord?
No, it's the same. It's the same. So, you know, for instance, when it says that the Lord has six different types of expansions, you know, Leela avatars, Purusha avatars, Yuga avatars, Satyavesha avatars,
Guna
avatars. So, you know, therefore, you know, Brahma is an incarnation of the Lord himself. And that also includes the universal form. You know,
Brahma is the incarnation of the Lord, is it?
What's that?
Lord Brahma is the incarnation.
Yeah, he's a Guna avatar.
Guna.
Mm.
So we consider, you know, Lord Brahma himself is an incarnation of the Lord.
But it is said that even as human beings, if he performs sacrifices and meditation for thousands of lives, then he can become Brahma.
Yes. When we say that Lord Brahma is an incarnation of the Lord, it means that the spirit soul is Jiva Tattva, not Vishnu Tattva. But that spirit soul is part of the Lord's energy, fraction of the Lord. So therefore, it's part of the Lord. And the material covering of that Jiva is also the energy of the Lord. But that particular living entity and his body, which makes up the universal form, is directly under the supervision of, you know, Gaudadaksha Vishnu. Therefore, is an incarnation, Vivanamsa. So, because, you know, Lord Brahma is directly under the supervision of Gaudadaksha Vishnu, even though he's a jiva, and therefore he's considered to be an incarnation of the Lord. Because the jiva and his body, both subtle and gross, are energies of the Lord. So therefore it is actually a manifestation of Lord Brahma, is a manifestation of the Lord's energy under his direct supervision. And therefore he's an incarnation of the Lord. So, you know, therefore we say that Lord Brahma and or the universal form is an incarnation of the Lord. You know, so you know, you can say the universal form is the expansion of the Lord, and you can say the universal form is the expansion of Brahma's body. It's the same thing.
Prabhu, but we said that Brahma is material.
Hmm.
Even Brahma is material.
The universal
and
form.
How can the incarnation of the Lord be material?
He's representing the Lord. He's not the Lord.
Well, yeah, the. The Guna avatar means that he has. There are three incarnations, and Lord Brahma is Guna avatar. So we said six incarnations. I think I only mentioned five. Leela avatar, Purusha avatar, Leela avatar, Yuga avatar, Satyavesha avatar, Guna avatar, Manvantara. That's it. The Manvantaras, they're also, you know, considered material personalities. Not all of them are completely situated on the spiritual platform. They're also considered one of the six incarnations of the Lord. So these yogis, they, you know, and what have you, they enter into the form of the Lord. The form of Lord Brahma, sorry. They enter into the form of Lord Brahma, and then at the very end of Brahma's life, they enter into Gavadaksha Vishnu.
Even the South India temple, there is a temple Sri Rangam. In Sri Rangam, you know, are they praying to the Garbhodakasha Vishnu? Because the deity is Lord Vishnu's deity, and from his navel, the lotus comes and Brahma is situated there. So is it like, is it a, is it that, is it like a Garbhodakasha Vishnu worship?
Yes, well, if Brahma is there, that's Gavadaksha Vishnu. But Gavadaksha Vishnu is non different from Mahavishnu.
So, which means the destination is after the life they enter into the body of Garbhodakasha Vishnu, not Vaikuntha.
Some. That's where we're up to now. That some of them who worship Harangagarb, which means they may be yogis who worship the universal form. They may be worshippers of Brahma, who's also known as Hiranyagarbha. You know, is the because the collective of all the jivas are, an aspect of Brahma's form. The universe, the universal form, is another aspect of Brahma's form, and then there's the four-headed Brahma. So, they, you know, people may worship Lord Brahma, the universal form, or the super soul of both, who is Gavadaksha Vishnu. In any of those categories, they worship the Lord, they may be eligible to enter into Lord Brahma at the time of dissolution, and then Brahma enters into Gavadaksha Vishnu. Now, according to those visions, we're going to work out, do they come back? Do they go on? What happens?
But probably these devotees in Sri Rangam, they worship directly in Bhakti Yoga. They don't worship the universal form of the Lord, or they don't worship as yogis. So then you would think that they directly go to Vaikuntha.
Yes, they can. That's right. That's what's explained here. That's what we're going to say. That some of them do. Well, some of them, that's actually, we read that, that some of them, by worshipping the Lord himself, and the, you know, Vedic mantras that describe the one who understands the Purusha avatars, they can be liberated, they can go back to Godhead, you know, directly, if there's sufficient bhakti. So we're going to look at why some of them come back, and why some of them, you know, it described, Prabhupada mentioned here in verse 8, alright, the words parasya para chintataha mean those who are fully Krishna conscious. Such persons enter directly into the kingdom of God, the Vaikunthas. Or, if they are worshippers of the plenary portion of Gavadaksha Vishnu, then they remain within this universe until dissolution, and after that they enter. Yeah. So some directly enter. So in other words, for instance, Prabhupada, if he goes to Sri Rangam and worships the form of the Lord, you know, as Gavadaksha Vishnu or Mahavishnu, you know, Prabhupada, that doesn't mean that, you know, if Prabhupada goes there and offers, you know, Sri Rangam some flowers, that he's going to have to wait. He can't directly go back to Godhead. Because he's fully Krishna conscious, even though he worships that form, he has a full understanding. Full Krishna consciousness means that we understand that the Purusha avatars are expansions of Narayana. You know, Mahasankarshan, who's, you know, who's an expansion of, you know, one of the Chaturvyuha, and the Chaturvyuha are expansions of Narayana, situated, you know, surrounding Narayana. So that is full Krishna conscious, and that, you know, even more full Krishna conscious is they understand that Lord Narayana is non-different from Krishna. That so therefore they can worship Gavadaksha Vishnu, and they go directly back to Godhead because they're fully Krishna conscious. Some people can go to, you know, Sri Rangam and worship the form of the Lord, and may not be fully Krishna conscious. they may not understand that, you know, the Purusha avatars are expansions of the transcendental Lord who exists beyond material creation. They may understand the Purusha avatars as, you know, part of the material manifestation, such as the impersonal saintly philosophers, you know, the what have you. So they're not fully Krishna conscious, so therefore they're, you know, worshipping the Lord. Still, because they're worshipping the Lord, there's some benefit in that if it's sufficient, they may actually achieve Brahma Loka, enter into Brahma's body and be liberated along with Brahma. But there are still conditions, there are further conditions. So, see? So, you know, it is, it's the development of your consciousness of, you know, approaching the Lord in a material way, with a material understanding of the Lord, and with material motives that determine your destination.
So we wait till the devolution?
Yes.
So where do they wait? Like, what happens to them?
Well, some of them may actually reside, you know, as it describes here, that verse 10, is it? After, you know, it describes the verse, the yogis, see, verse 9 is describing that after two Puradas, you know, 100 years of Brahma, the material universe is going to close up. Right? And the yogis who have reached the planet of Brahma, they give up their bodies and they enter into the body of Lord Brahma. Now, those yogis may have been living on lower planetary systems and then understood that now we're coming to the dissolution of the universe, we must go to Brahma Loka, give up our body, enter into Brahma and go back. Okay.
And where do they go back? What's their destination? They enter into Lord Brahma, and then?
Then they enter into Garbhadakshaya
Vishnu,
along with Brahma.
No, not Mahavishnu, so just go
into Garbhadakshaya. First Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, along with all everyone that's within him, he will enter within Mahavishnu, because when Mahavishnu breathes in, all the universes enter. And that means Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, you know, again, you know, resides within the form of Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu withdraws that form of his, that expansion of his. In the same way, you know, Krishna may, you know, appear in 16,108 different forms to be with each of his wives. But if there's no need for those 16,108 forms, in other words, he has left the palace of all the queens and goes to the assembly house, then he goes in one form. So Mahavishnu, when there's no need for the expansions of his form, then they just once again, you know, withdrawn within his form. It's the same principle. And, you know, because Lord Brahma is within the form of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, along with all the, you know, living entities, particularly entities in his form, they become, they enter the body of Lord Vishnu, Mahavishnu.
So Narada Muni, that's how he goes into the form of the Lord, and then the next person he gets liberated, they say.
Yes.
So Narada Muni goes into the Lord, when there's a dissolution, he goes into the body of the Lord.
Yeah.
They have described, and then
yeah.
He says that afterwards, when the universe is again born, I was again born and I got an eternal body.
Yes.
So this is how Narada Muni got liberated.
Yes. Although, I, as far as I understand, as we said, that sometimes there is this scenario at the end of Brahma's life, which can actually happen at the end of half of his life. And my understanding was that, it was then
in half of
that Narada Muni appeared.
During half of Brahma.
Yeah. But
but Prabhu is described, he got his spiritual body immediately. He didn't like lightning, he left his material body and got a spiritual body.
Yes, but he got that spiritual form. Therefore, you know, when he appeared from Lord Brahma, you know, he appeared in that spiritual form which he had received, you know, very quickly.
But then he was a pure devotee. He knew he wasn't a yogi, or he wasn't an impersonalist, or so why did he why couldn't he go directly to Vaikuntha?
Because he as a pure devotee of the Lord, he wanted to preach Krishna consciousness throughout the universe. Narada Muni is, you know, one of the Shakta Vaishavatars of the Lord, who specifically preaches bhakti throughout the universe. There always has to be someone who helps to spread bhakti. Shakta Vaishavatar who helps to spread bhakti, and that was Narada Muni.
So on the body of our night servant son, we entered the Vishnu.
Yeah. At the end of 50 years. Yeah, that's my understanding. I've got some notes on that, but as far as I understood, that it was at that time, at the end of. I'll just have to check that, but it was, you know, my understanding was the end of that 50 years. Therefore, that, you know, Narada Muni appeared in the second half. But it doesn't mean to say that there wasn't a Narada Muni in the first part.
He was cursed possibly by Lakshya, but he never stayed in one place.
Yeah.
Because he, I think he, all is all Lakshya's sons. This is not the Lakshya who was from Shiva, this is the same Lakshya who appeared later. It's the same person.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
There's only one Daksha.
Yeah, but he appears twice.
He appears. Now, now it describes here. So he's saying to his mother that, you know, by devotional service, take direct shelter of the Supreme Lord who's seated in everyone's heart. So he's advising her to directly go back to Godhead. Because in verses 12 to 15, it describes that, my dear mother, someone may worship the Supreme Lord with a special interest. But even many demigods, such as Brahma and the Kumaras and etc., etc., they actually have to come back to the material world again. Brahma and the great sages come back under the influence of the time factor. Although they are liberated and they attain the first incarnation of the Purush, still at the time of creation they come back in exactly the same forms and portions as they had previously. Right, so now this is an important purport because it is describing 12 to 15. So Brahma's entered the body, he's entered the form of the Lord, and they've come back. Goodness gracious. And it describes why. Here the word Veda Drishtya occurs because Brahma has a slight inclination to think that he is as independent as Rudra. Sometimes Brahma thinks that he is independent of the Supreme Lord, and the worshipper also thinks that he is independent. For this reason, after destruction of this material world, when there is again creation, under the interaction of the modes of material nature, Brahma comes back. So although he reaches the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the first Purusha incarnation, Mahavishnu, so we know, you know, he's entered within Garbhadaksha Vishnu, it's confirmed that Garbhadaksha Vishnu has entered into Mahavishnu, still he cannot stay in the spiritual world. Prabhupada uses the term here, spiritual world, so sometimes in this chapter it's saying that they go back to the spiritual world. So therefore we see that sometimes when Prabhupada is referring to the spiritual world, he's referring it to it in the sense that they've literally entered the form of the Lord. And sometimes when Prabhupada is saying is that, you know, that they enter the spiritual world, he's saying they directly go back to Vaikuntha. But just keep in mind that he uses that same term for both.
So one is directly going back, and
the other one's actually going to Vaikuntha, and one, you know, beyond the material world, one's staying within the material world because they enter the form of Mahavishnu. Mm-hmm. Mahavishnu resides, you know, on the Karana Ocean.
Yeah.
You know, just in between material and spiritual existence, which means they don't quite get to the other shore of the spiritual sky. So they didn't actually really.
So they refer to that for both.
Yeah, some of them only get that far, and they have to come back. Right, there's a slight inclination to become one or independent. They have to come back. We were discussing, you know, the yogis. Some of the yogis, sages, even Brahma himself, if they have that slight independence from the Lord, because we read in the second chapter, second canto, chapter 9, verse number 19 or 9, I think it is, that in the spiritual world, even, you know, the demons and the demigods, they all worship the Lord, you know, without dissension. There's no revolutionary spirit. There's no independence. They're all happy to just serve the Lord. Without that spirit, you don't go to Vaikuntha. You know, therefore, it's described that even personalities like Devas and Muni, sometimes they, you know, they can approach Vaikuntha, which means that they can go to the form of, you know, the Lord within the universe, which is, and that is considered not different from Vaikuntha. So they've actually entered Vaikuntha, Devas and Muni entered Vaikuntha, because, you know, the Lord's, you know, spiritual planet within this universe is not different from Vaikuntha. But because there's an independent spirit, or any other, you know, anomalies within the consciousness, they can't remain there. Even though they can enter, they can't remain there. Some of the acharyas mentioned that, you know, the Lord arranges this, you know, for the pleasure of the devotees in Vaikuntha, that, you know, sometimes, you know, the devotees see, oh, you know, this person has come from the material world, you know, and then, you know, it's sort of interesting. It's here's Devas. What is he doing here? Oh, he's created some offence. Then he has to go back. You know, not that that's, you know, why the Lord, but he allows them to enter. You know, they can enter, but they can't stay.
But do the Kumaras cannot say that either?
Well, it's describing here in this verse that, you know, sometimes, in particular, in certain incarnations, the Kumaras are in that category.
Why does he allow someone like Devas Muni to enter?
He allowed him to enter to show us that even someone is so powerful that they have direct communication with the Lord, Brahma and Shiva, that person, no matter so powerful, is still, if they offend a devotee, nothing can protect them. That's why he allows it. That's like the ultimate powerful position, that you can personally, face to face, have dealings with Lord Vishnu. That's even greater than face to face dealings with Shiva or Brahma. You can personally associate with and see, you know, even Lord Brahma, he doesn't always get to see Vishnu. He stands on the shore of the ocean and, you know, offers prayers. Devasa Muni can go there. He's a very, very exalted, powerful personality. And the Lord's showing that even that powerful person, if they create an offence to a Vaishnava, there is nothing that can protect that person despite all that power. And yogi. So that is there, and you know, there's also some amusement up by Kunta.
You offended Ambarish Mahaprabhu?
Yes. He offended the Lord's devotees.
But normally we say that the Brahma in this universe is a pure devotee of the Lord.
Yeah.
So will he also come back?
Yeah. Yeah, as far as I understand, our Brahma is just, you know, pure body. We'll go back to God in a time.
So this is talking not about this particular Brahma, but Brahmas in general.
Yes, so, you know, there's always a Brahma, there's always four Kumaras, there's always a Narada Muni. Because, you know, those jobs need to be done, you know. The eternal incarnations, the Lord always expands, eternally expands as, you know, the Kumaras, the Narada Muni, like that, but Brahma. But, you know, they sometimes go back to Godhead, and therefore, you know, other living entities take their place. Or sometimes those living entities actually fall from their position. You know, Brahma can actually, you know, from being Lord Brahma, can actually end up in the form of a worm-eating stool.
Yeah, but this is just the reverse of Brahma in during all creations. That's what she was saying, not just in this particular creation.
This verse is saying that, you know, referring to, you know, in any creation, any of these personalities, all the way up to Lord Brahma, can come back, even they've attained. Literally entering within the form, the spiritual form of Purusha Avatar, but that slight trace of, you know, which, you know, is strong in another sense, but it's there. It means they must come back.
So does this mean that even those impersonalists who have a bit of bhakti and are therefore able to merge into the rays of the Lord also fall down because they have that separate interest?
Yes. So, you know, fully Krishna conscious means no independence, you know, no independent mood. Krishna gives them full independence, but, you know, they use it properly. They surrender their independence. Krishna gives them full independence and they utilize that fully for Krishna. That's full Krishna consciousness. And without that, you know, they're misusing that independence or thinking themselves somewhat independent. They misuse it because they think they're independent from the Lord, or as good as, or equal with. Any of those conceptions mean they have to come back.
And that's the same with the liberation that Lord Shiva can give, because it says that Lord Shiva can give him personal liberation.
Yes. You know, therefore, ultimately, you know, the can't give liberation because, you know, if he gives him personal liberation, you know, it won't hold. Unless they come, you know, unless one comes to the platform of bhakti, the liberation that's awarded even by Lord Shiva will not hold. They must come back again to material existence. But, you know, feel big foot. Until they take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, as long as they think they're independent from the lotus feet of the Lord, even if Lord Shiva has awarded them independence, they must come back. Even if they, you know, they've attained liberation by entering in Brahma and entering into Gavanakshaya Vishnu and within the form of Purush Avatar. That's actually liberation. But again, they have to come back. You know, that is a form of liberation, to enter within the form of the Lord. They've attained liberation. They have to come back. In all those circumstances, until they actually take full shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Now, apart from those, so we have a lot of very elevated personalities, and then of course there are others in lower modes of material nature, and, you know, worshipping the forefathers, improving their economic condition and what have you. They're called Trivagika. They're interested in three elevating processes, but they're averse to the personality of Godhead. They're not interested in his pastimes. They're somewhat condemned, this category. They're compared to stool-eating hogs. They give up hearing the transcendental activities of the Lord and indulge in the hearing of abominable activities of materialistic persons. As Prabhupada says, you know, such persons, you present them with a Srimad Bhagavatam, a Bhagavad Gita, Vishnu Puranas, etc., even the Bible, the Quran, they're not interested. The hog is interested in eating stool. If the hog is offered some nice preparation made of condensed milk or ghee, he won't like it. He would prefer obnoxious, bad-smelling stool, and he finds it very relishable. Now that seems quite harsh, but it's true. You know when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, I'm not sure he went, but he sent some preachers. I can't remember whether he actually went, but some of his preachers and his disciples went to Burma to preach. And the devotees used to daily cook, you know, halva and you know, puris and, you know, sabji and ghee. And the local people were, horrible, you know, like that. And the devotees, they noticed that on practically every house, at the front of the door, they used to keep like a big pot or a barrel type thing, like maybe a big clay pot or something. And it stuck, like really foul. And they asked, you know, the local, what is that? They said what they do is that in there they put in, you know, all the scrap foods, all sorts of living entities, insects, lizards, birds, anything that dies, they put it in there. They let it ferment months and months and months, and when they have a big festival, they drink it as a wine. And the smell was so foul, you know, the devotees just about knock you out. So they were considering the halva and this and that and the other to be disgusting, but they were considering this to be nectar. You know, when I got my first house as a grihastha, way back, I moved into the house, and of course in those days people hated the Hare Krishna, especially the locals. They just wanted to get rid of this thing, you know. If they knew you were a Hare Krishna, they would not rent you a house, mm-hmm. under no conditions. Anyway, I managed to, you know, put my wig on. It was a wig. Put my wig on, my hat, dressed up, went there, and said, "Oh, you know, looking for a house." Now, this person even asked me, you know, I think from memory, like he was saying, you know, "You're not one of those Hare Krishnas, you know, like the horrible guy." Yeah, I wouldn't rent a house. Anyway, he bought it, you know. He actually thought I was a non-devotee, and he let me rent his house, you know, from the estate agent. So then, what happened was that the owner obviously found out that the Hare Krishnas had rented his house, and he was furious. And he came around one day, you know, banging on the doors. Now, I'd moved in and I thought the house like was just a pigsty, so I spent the whole week just cleaning it. On my hands and knees, I had a little toothbrush, all the cracks like that. So I'd actually spent a massive amount of time just, you know, because the devotee standards it. And I was really happy, yeah, so because we were going to have live there and chant and what have you. So then he'd come in and he banged on the door and he'd come in. He goes, "You filthy Hare Krishnas, you're not staying in my house. You get out right now. I am not renting like this." And I said, no, you come in, you'll see that I've actually cleaned up your house, which was a bit messy." He goes, you like that horrible smelly incense, and you cook this horrible food, and you smell out the whole neighborhood like this." He was serious. So serious that... we used to, because we didn't have any furniture, which wasn't unusual in those days. So we were sleeping in the front room, and one night we were sleeping there, and all of a sudden this brick comes flying through the window. Glass smashes everywhere. You know, so determined that, you know, that these horrible, smelly, you know, Hare Krishnas, you know, animals, you know, that's what they thought. And I thought, "Oh God, if the owner sees this window, he's going to really kick us out." So I actually fixed the window, got a new paint, you know, painted a lot and everything. And I thought, you know, great. And then I think we got bricked again. But the second time, I managed to see the car that was speeding off. And I went to see the owner. I found out he owned a pub, and I was going to tell him that I'd seen the car. And when I saw the car, it was his car. It was the owner. The owner. And I realised the owner's, you know, trying to get us out. I'm trying to, you know. So, but you know, that sort of mentality that, you know, they considered that our food, our incense, you know, everything was like, you know, disgusting. You know, and we're thinking they were unclean. So, you know, it's. I remember one time I run like a crossways in Adelaide for some time, and I served this one guest. You know, he come in and, you know, he said, "Oh, what's this?" And I said, "You know, it's vegetarian food." And I said, "I'll give you a little taste. You know, I'll give you a little bit of halva," and I. You know, put just a little bit on his plate, and he took it with a spoon. He ate it, and he spat like he spatted everywhere. But oh, you know, just it was just horrible for him. You know, he spat it all over the table. So, you know, so disgusting too. So, you know, it's it may seem like an exaggeration, but you'd be surprised.
There are many meat eaters who like Indian vegetarian food generally. So what's the...
Anyway, it's saying that generally people who are averse to the personality of God in there, you know, they can be compared to stool-eating hogs. You know, they're eating something which is actually disgusting. And they're rejecting something which is nectar. That's the point. So meat eaters like that, you know, they in general. There are many aspects of life that they reject. They may accept some of them, but they reject a lot of aspects of life which are quite Nectarian, ambrosial, and they eat things which are, you know, quite disgusting.
The argument, what is, it's considered cool to think and to say that people have different tastes. So you can't tell someone else what is good or what is bad or what is correct and what is wrong. That is, even a lot of people say that without even thinking.
Yeah, look, you know, in America, even, you know, several decades ago, you could go to some underground restaurants and you know, for dinner you could eat the fetuses of aborted children. You know, so one can say, you know, yes, everyone has their own taste, but it's obvious that, you know, a normal person, you know, that everyone has their own taste, but some person's tastes are more refined, civilized, and elevated. So yes, there are. When someone says, "Oh, everyone to their own taste," yeah, that's a fact. That some people enjoy things which are actually enjoyed by people with no discrimination. Some people enjoy things where they have mixed discrimination, and some people enjoy things where they have a very high degree of discrimination. So yes, everyone has different tastes. So you can say to them, which category are you in? Are you in the category where you have no discrimination, mixed discrimination, or very high discrimination? That's the answer to that. So, you know, there's a little discussion. You know, Kapila Muni, of course, is advising his mother, you go back to Godhead directly. You know, and, you know, you worship the Lord fully in Krishna consciousness and directly go back to Godhead. Yes.
Why would it say such stool eaters actually have to go to Krishna? Shouldn't there be some ox?
Well, you know, what happens is that such persons, you know, are generally very attached to their family members. So if they're a human being and they're extremely attached to their family members, they can go to Pitraloka, but then they'll come back to Earth. If they've been, you know, well, when they come back to Earth, if they perform sinful activities in order to maintain their family members, like that, we read that somewhere here, yeah, that sometimes they, you know, perform, because they're so attached, you know, they'll do all sorts of sinful activities for their family, which then they can take birth, you know, in, as hogs and worms and straw, like that. So, you know, it's very dangerous to be so attached to one's relatives that you're prepared to commit any type of sinful activity, even in the name of religion. That's a very dangerous position to have. I mean, attachment, you know, for the benefit of yourself and others is good, but you know, attachment to that degree is detrimental.
So, when at school, when we're studying for English or something, we would read how in England, for example, because of all the industrial revolutions and all that, there were so many extraordinarily poor people, and they would do literally, because they had nowhere to stay, no money, somehow or other they had to somehow or other get food for their family. So they would do anything from petty stealing to more serious crimes to get food. So how would a person who
who's read the Bhagavatam behave ideally, and what is the understanding that enables them to behave in that way, even in such extreme circumstances where their children have nothing to eat, they have nothing to eat.
Yeah. Well, you know, India is a very good example that, you know, when the culture is there, even to some degree, people will accept their lot in life and remain pious. When a pious person, you know, such as we used to find a lot, you know, more in India, when a pious person suffers, they should become more beautiful in their worship of the Lord. When an impious person suffers, they become more sinful. Prabhupada mentions. So, you know, they're both in the same condition, but if they, you know, they have sinful traits, they will take that opportunity to become sinful. Whereas actually a pious person, even if in the same situation, they don't become dishonest.
What is the understanding of the pious person that enables them to remain honest when, even when they're seeing, for example, maybe their children starving?
No, they understand, you know, right from wrong. If, you know, if your children are starving, you go out and you provide food. But, you know, there are many other ways to do it besides stealing.
In those circumstances, it was such that there wasn't even any proper job for them to do because of the industrial revolutions and all that. They were displaced from their villages, from their farms. And
go to the forest. You can't live in the forest. There's nothing to eat in the forest. If there's no food where you're living, then go to where there's food. Or there's no food in any of the forests or any of the fields, anywhere. That's simple. I mean, a lot of that is, you know, that going to the forest means they'd have to become a little detached, you know, because all their relatives and, you know, there's a bodily conception that, you know, how can I leave my family? It's actually, you know, the horror for them is if I go to the forest where there's plenty of food, I have to leave my family, you know, my other relatives, or my village. My father was brought up here, my grandfather, his father. Let me stay here where I'm attached and just become simple. Otherwise, you know, if you're not attached, you just say, well, there's plenty of food in the forest, I'll go there and take my children with me and feed them. Therefore, you see that, as you say, in India, you know, there are many situations where people went without food for some time due to certain situations, but, you know, many of them would actually just become more devoted to God, and, you know, they'd get through the difficult times, but they wouldn't become dishonest. You know, generally, there would be so much opportunity, as I say, you can go to the forest, this, that, and the other, if every single option to feed oneself and one's family in a pious way, there is not one single option, then, you know, a person may steal. And that would not be considered wrong. And actually, that would not be considered wrong. But generally you don't find that. Generally people are impious and, you know, they'll take the first opportunity to, you know, an impious person when there's difficulty, they'll take that as an opportunity to manifest their impious nature, to act upon the impious desires that they have, that are there. When there's no other resort, certainly, but generally that's not the case. If you've exhausted every possible avenue and there's no other way, you wouldn't let your children or people die. You have to do whatever has to be done, like to the minimum. You don't go out and just kill someone for a loaf of bread. You might steal a loaf of bread, but you don't have to kill people. You do the absolute minimum. But the first choice is always to try and do the honest thing. Want to jump on a boat and go to a different country? You're attached. Okay, so the Lord has explained. He has explained this path of understanding the absolute truth by which one can come to understand the real truth, the matter and spirit, and the relationship. All this philosophical research culminates in understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. After understanding this, when one becomes free from the material mode of nature, he attains his stage of devotional service. Either by devotional service directly or by philosophical research, one has to find the same destination, which is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, here Lord Kapila is explaining that, if you, through philosophical philosophical research, one may come to understand the absolute, understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, that understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the beginning understanding, in the sense that He exists. The Supreme Lord exists. He is the control of the material world. I am part of His energy and I must serve Him. These things are understanding, but actually at that point one takes the devotional service, and through devotional service the real understanding of the Personality of Godhead begins. So in other words, there's enough understanding of the Lord literally to take the devotional service fully, and even coming to that point means that the philosophical research has had some degree of bhakti, which has allowed you to understand that basic criteria about the Lord, as being the supreme controller, the source of everything, where is the term. There must be some bhakti in that research, but then coming to that understanding, one actually has to take the bhakti in order to develop the full, proper understanding of the Personality of Godhead. What are His activities? The nature of His birth and His appearance. And things like that. One can attain that's the stage of the Bhagavad Gita. One can attain that same place, one can attain the same destination by devotional service without philosophical research. Yeah. That Lord, in verse 37, he said, "My dear mother, I have explained to you the process of devotional service and its identity in four different social divisions. I've explained to you as well as how eternal time is chasing the living entities, although it is imperceptible to them. There are varieties of material existence for the living entity according to the work it performs in ignorance of forgetfulness. It's a very dangerous thing to fall into that forgetfulness, once one's in that state of forgetfulness, ignorance, there's no telling where, you know, how many different material bodies one will end up in, you know, for how many countless universal manifestations. Very dangerous situation. The Lord Kapila says, so he's explained, but still, it's not meant for people who are envious, for agnostics, or for persons who are unclean in their behavior, not for hypocrites or persons proud of the material possessions. It's not to be instructed to persons who are too greedy to attach to family life, nor to persons who are non-devotees and who are envious of the devotees of the personality of Godhead. It should be given to the faithful devotee who is respectful to the spiritual master. So here he's saying, even when it comes to the devotee, this instruction is not just meant for that anyone. The devotee specifically has to be a faithful devotee who's actually respectful to the spiritual master. That means both the Diksha and Shiksha gurus. Non-envious, friendly to all living entities, eager to render service with faith and sincerity. It's not to be imparted by the spiritual master to persons who have taken the Lord to be, it should be imparted to this, by the spiritual master to persons who have taken the Lord to be more dear than anything. They're not envious of anyone, they're perfectly cleansed, they're detached from that which is outside the purview of Krishna consciousness. Very nice purport here, very important purport.
What one?
42. Now, here bhakti means one who does not hesitate to accept the reformatory processes for becoming a bhakta. Now, in order to become a devotee, one has to accept the spiritual master and inquire from him how to progress in devotional service. To serve a devotee, to chant the holy name, according to a certain counting method, to worship the deity, to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Gita, and to live in a sacred place, they're five very important chief activities, and one who accepts those is called a devotee. Yeah. One should not be unnecessarily envious of his godbrothers. Rather, if a godbrother is more enlightened and advanced in Krishna consciousness, one should accept him as almost equal to the spiritual master, and one should be happy to see such godbrothers advance in Krishna consciousness. Quite a strong statement, because we see that Srila Prabhupada, his godbrothers, some of them were envious of him. Actually, they should have accepted him as being almost equal to their spiritual master, and very happy to see that he advanced so much. There is a tendency that, we're talking about ISKCON, so this is not talking about out of ISKCON, but you see this a lot, that people think, there's my spiritual master who I give utmost respect to, and whatever anyone else's qualifications, I don't need to offer them respect or take them seriously, and even I'm a bit envious of that person, but it doesn't really matter. As long as I'm serving my spiritual master, nicely. That's completely refuted here by Prabhupada. One should accept, devotees, if they consider that they're, very enlightened, advancing, that they should accept them equal to, almost equal to spiritual master. You see this quite often, especially when people's gurus come. Some disciples are really good in that when their spiritual master comes, they actually become more nicer, respectful to how they deal with devotees. And some devotees, when they're spiritual master comes, become obnoxious. No, it's a fact. They become quite obnoxious. The guru calls for something, and they'll just literally barge through all the devotees, bowl on them over, disregarding, anything that they, like their whole existence means nothing. And the guru is after something, and they'll trample everyone until they get that thing and take it back to the guru and present the others. Serving the guru, making so much advancement. You see that sort of thing. It's there, but especially when people's gurus come, what's there becomes, stands out, like a sore thumb. If that envy manifests, actually, according to Lord Kapila, those persons are not eligible. They're only eligible for some basic instruction, these instructions of Lord Kapila, and not even suitable. Here, Prabhupada says that a devotee should always be very kind to the general public in instructing Krishna consciousness. That's the real humanitarian work. So that's how we, serve the spiritual master, both personally and by preaching. Such persons who serve the spiritual master and preach, they're bona fide candidates. So they're thinking of the welfare of other living entities. Now, sometimes you see devotees who, even as devotees, they can maintain quite envious attitude towards non-devotees, a complete lack of preaching and compassion. That's not a good sign. Such persons, may not be eligible for certain levels of instruction. The bona fide spiritual master must see the bona fide quality of the person who is going to initiate. An unworthy person should not be initiated. Prabhupada mentions also that in the previous purport he describes that there are so-called disciples who become submissive to a spiritual master most artificially with an ulterior motive. They also cannot understand what Krishna consciousness or devotional service is. So sometimes, people are very submissive, but in a most artificial way. There's some other purpose than, ulterior motive in that submissiveness to the guru. Even within ISKCON, it happens. Sometimes people come to Krishna consciousness, but they're, fixed in some other faith. Even some of the faiths that Lord Kapila has condemned. We even see this amongst the Hindu community. That sometimes, you say that Krishna is God, there's another vision. Or
they regard everyone as equal.
Or
demigods.
They worship demigods.
They think it's equal to Krishna.
So, it does happen. He says, we have experienced that some students come to join us, but because of being biased in some particular type of faith, they leave our camp and become lost in the wilderness. know, I've seen devotees that you have discussions with them and they just can't come to the same level of understanding Krishna, and they literally just go away. Actually Krishna consciousness is not a sectarian religious faith. It is a teaching process for understanding the Supreme Lord and our eternal relationship with Him. It's a very important statement. Krishna consciousness is universally applicable. It's just the science of God and our eternal relationship. Therefore, it's meant for every living entity. Not just humans, but every living entity, ultimately, for their benefit, help them to come to that. Anyone can join this movement without prejudice, but unfortunately there are persons who feel differently. It is better, therefore, not to instruct the science of Krishna consciousness unto such persons. Generally, materialistic persons are after some name, fame, and material gain, so if someone takes the Krishna consciousness for these reasons, he will never be able to understand this philosophy. So here Prabhupada is saying that sometimes people come to Krishna consciousness, they may have come just for name, fame and material gain. I actually see it all the time. Throughout the whole court, it's not a... You would have to say that predominantly people are sincere, but this is more common than what one may imagine.
Is it? But Prabhu, I would say, judging from myself, that these things are there. Like, for example, I may start something with all sincerity, but then emotions of envy or pride or all these things may come later on. So it's isn't it a question of degree?
Yeah, it is a question of degree. here Prabhupada says that even if one is not greedy for material possessions but is too attached to family life, he still cannot understand Krishna consciousness. Superficially, such persons are not very greedy for material possessions, but they are too attached to wife, children and family improvement. So when a person is not contaminated by the above mentioned faults, yet in the ultimate issue is not interested in serving the Supreme Lord, or if he is a non-devotee, he also cannot understand the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Waste of time.
That seems like...
That's very strong, isn't it?
It seems like everyone...
Oh, no, not at all. No.
That's when I read the proposal, in fact, that's what came to my mind. Says that don't give devotional service to people who are envious, who are this and that. This, we go out preaching, everybody is envious. We are ourselves envious. It is only by that we are envious of, that's our original fault. We are envious of Krishna. So we need to be slowly, slowly purified of that.
Yeah,
so when we say we don't give it to anybody who is envious and all that, is it that for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has been so merciful, he has given it to everybody, but Shankya philosophy is for only people who are elevated, is it that?
It's saying here that, so it says here, instruction should be given to the faithful devotee who is respectful to the spiritual master, the non-envious, and the friendly to all kinds of living entities, and eager to render service with faith and sincerity. So, that overrides whatever contamination is there in their heart. What this verse is saying is they lack those qualifications. If they have those qualifications, then
initially when I came to ISKCON, I did not have those qualifications. It's only by hearing about people, slowly I got purified. I was thinking all gods are one, and I would say that I do not have any of these qualifications.
Well,
it is only after I've come to ISKCON, I've gone to some of the programs, I've I'm chanting, slowly is refining me. There's still lots more,
but that's how it is.
No, we develop these qualifications as we progress.
Oh, they do develop, but they should be.
But then if you say you can't give devotional service to such people, that then there's no starting point at all.
No. There has to be a degree, you know, of these qualities.
Yeah, I mean.
So, for instance, you know, when you come along, you've obviously, you know, sat there and at least listened.
Receptive.
You know, so you've listened and then you've gone away and you thought, I said this part, but gee, I've got, you know, a million questions. You know, I don't agree with that. But then, you know, you've gone again and then you've listened again. Now, here we're talking about persons who, you know, think, well, you know, I'm not listening to that person. I've got nothing to learn from them. Even as a devotee, even sometimes a person who appears to be, aspiring, unfortunately, sometimes people even get to the point where they're initiated, because sometimes people are very tricky, you know, in putting on a pretense that they've got the qualifications. You know. But it is most superficial. Prabhupada points out that you know, sometimes it does happen that people, you know, appear to be very submissive. They can even take initiation. The spiritual master is trying to work out who's you know, qualified and who's not, but some of them can slip through. Very, very duplicitous. You know, they have ulterior motives, and they can show that, you know, they're very submissive and want to follow, but they don't. You know, they just want, you know, some money. They want some fame. They want a good life, and they're not really interested in serving the Supreme Lord, and they're a bit envious of the devotees, and they're not particularly interested in taking their instructions. So, you know, these things show up. There are degrees. You judge as best as you can that if people at least sit and hear, and they'll hear you out properly, that's a good sign. If they do that a lot, that's a good sign. But even sometimes some people can actually do that in a very superficial way for a long period and still slip through. So then, you know, when that people have heard for a while, then you may engage them in some service, and that's a really good way to test, okay, you know, there seems to be some sincerity that at least you've heard me out, and that then they may do some service, and others at that point say, look, you know, I'm coming along, but don't ask me to do anything, you know. You get that, you know. It's like, so then even sometimes some of them do some service because you're not really asking them something. They're thinking, I don't really, really want to do this, but, you know, it's advancing my particular goals, and I'd actually, you know, I'd have a worse job if I wasn't here doing this, which I don't want to do. I'd be doing something worse, you know, because of some other material situation. I might as well do this. They're not really interested in the service, but they're actually thinking, oh, you know, if I get in the ashram, I don't have to pay rent, you know, people like that. Well, I want to get in the ashram. It's like a, you know, cozy situation, you know, no bills. So then, you know, people may even do some service, but, you know, if they're actually, you know, quite superficial in the fact about being a devotee, at some stage it shows up. At some stage it shows up. That envy will eventually come out. You know.
But what they're doing the service and not purify them? It's supposed to envy, not...
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that, you know, even some of those superficial people who are not, who actually come to Krishna consciousness and they completely, you know, have ulterior motives, sometimes they become purified and become devotees. But if they don't, then, you know, Krishna actually, he knows, and he gives everyone the opportunity, even the insincere, even the totally disqualified, especially Lord Chaitanya, he gives them the opportunity. But if after so much mercy from the Supreme Lord and his devotees, especially because that enviousness at some stage manifests and starts to create offences towards devotees, as Prabhupada's mentioning, that you know, even one's god brothers, you know, if they're actually nicely advanced in Krishna consciousness, one should treat them extremely respectfully, very carefully. But for an envious person, that's almost impossible. And quite often, some of these people can actually, it's not until they get positions of power that things can really, you know, manifest, because then they sometimes feel that, you know, now I don't have to answer to anyone and I can do the things, you know, that is on the, you know, so, you know, these things are there. I mean, it would, you know, it's in the Bhagavad Gita, it's Lord Kapila, he's giving us good advice. Not that we should...
No, I was thinking whether it's applicable to the Sankhya philosophy, because...
This
like
is devotional service.
We keep saying that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was merciful. He gave the chanting to each and everybody, without whether they were qualified or not. So he's a merciful incarnation, but that's the only incarnation. That Lord Kapila's instruction was much, much before that.
Yeah.
So I thought
Even in Lord Chaitanya's movie, one time Srila Gaura Kishore Das Babaji was chanting, and people used to come to see the Babaji. People that like to associate with sannyasis, gurus, GVCs, temple presidents, because if they're seen with them enough, they eat with them and they befriend them, they feel that they've actually become, it advances their fame and their name, and ultimately their facility. Me and the TP, me and the sannyasi, I know all the sannyasis and the GVCs, they're all my mates. So people then associate, you know, same with the guru. When the guru comes, sometimes people want to be the only person serving the guru, and they think, oh, you know, they must be so elevated because, you know, they're always with the guru, and I don't get to hardly see them. And they actually want to give this impression that I'm more elevated than you, and they keep people, others away, you know, I've got the guru myself. People can do that. They did that to Guru. They do it to, you know, every devotee, and they used to do it to Guru Kishore Das Babaji, because if you associate with Guru Kishore Das Babaji, and then you travel through India and you say, yes, I'm associated with Guru Kishore Das Babaji, we chant, you know, on the bank of the Ganges, you know, we're very renounced, and we have nothing to do. I want to establish temple here. Yes, yes, you are such a great devotee. You establish a temple. We will give you so much money. You know, you have a big wife and family. We'll maintain. Yes, yes, yes. And that's their motive. You know, they'll establish some center somewhere and people will just, you know, donate the money because they're considered to be an associate. The only way they can actually ever come to the platform being known as an advanced spiritual personality who everyone is donating facility to is not by anything that they can do, but by just associating with someone who's actually like that. It's most superficial. So anyway, Gaura Kishore Das Babaji one time said, you know, if you don't leave my presence and never come back, I will kill myself rather than associate with you. Get this person out of here. Don't let him come back. So this, you know, this person was sent away from his society because he could see, you know, that Gaura Kishore Das Babaji could immediately see everything superficial about, you know, he would just immediately say, you know, expose it. And so anyway, this man, he went to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakura, and he said, you know, you are his disciple, and you know, he's very angry at me, but you know, you please intervene, you please beg for his mercy and to be compassionate for me. I am very fallen, I am very offensive on this, you please beg for his mercy. The Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati approached Gaura Kishore Das Babaji. Gaura Kishore Das Babaji said, you know, Prabhu, you are practically the manifestation of Lord Nityananda's mercy. it's natural for you to be compassionate even for a rascal like this, but you should not intervene on his behalf, because his plea for mercy is just an affectation. You know, it is like a superficial pose. It's not real. And therefore he instructed him to intervene. And so he just left. But this is, he's saying, practically your manifestation of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda's mercy, there's no one more merciful than the devotee. And he's saying, but even you should not instruct these insincere impostors. It is not correct. It is not correct for you to do that. If he actually wanted the mercy of the Lord, yes, but he's not after the mercy of the Lord. He's after something. He's saying, you please beg for his mercy and the mercy of the Lord for me. That's not what he really wants. Therefore, don't ask for it, because he doesn't want it. He wants something else. He wants to, go and say, I'm a big devotee, a big associate, and get money and have sex and stuff like that. You're asking for the mercy of the Lord for him. He doesn't even want it. He wants something different. So, these things are there in our sampradaya. In our sampradaya, in our temples, in ISKCON. Not that we should look suspiciously at everyone, or you ask me a question, we first examine you. As we advance in Krishna consciousness, these things become very obvious. It's just like a child. A child comes to the parent, and the child may have taken 20 cents out of the parents' wallet or something, and hidden it under the pillow. The parent just looks at the child, you're up to something. It's like, it's written all over your face. It's just so obvious, and they'll just find, there's something, you've done something, and then they'll, usually they can tell according to, some of their actions or some of the statements, they'll work out what they've done. It's very obvious, So similarly, as one advances in Krishna consciousness, these sort of things become quite obvious, to devotees, that they can see it. The foolish people think that, no one ever to detect me, but Krishna consciousness means there's full light, full understanding. Everything is revealed fully to, the more Krishna conscious we are.
So eventually it shows up, all these qualities?
Well, for an advanced devotee, most of the time it shows up quite straight away. For others, if they're not so mature in their understanding of Krishna consciousness, it may show up after a long, long period of time. That's long. The more Krishna conscious a person is, the more they're able to spot these things almost immediately.
As the more perhaps the audience can spot it.
Almost immediately, yeah. Mm-hmm. Practically immediately. Yeah. So, that child may come to another parent, and the parent, the mother's going, my daughter's up to something. My son's up to something. And the other parents are thinking, I can't see it. I don't know. What are they doing? For the parent, it's obvious. It's like, I can see you're up to it. Other parents who are not the child's parent, they can't see it. So it's something that's standing out like a billboard to one person, and for another person, they can't see. And they're also in that. It's like that. So, therefore, we see how Prabhupada in his preaching, Prabhupada was quite often criticised by others for, preaching, you know, where's Radha Krishna, where's, you know, tell us about this, and that, you know. You know, so therefore Prabhupada's, you know, preaching of Krishna consciousness was to give the full mercy as far as possible, even to disqualified people, and at the same time not creating an offence to, you know, the Lord or his devotees by saying things to people that you shouldn't say them to. You know, so Prabhupada, that's you know, a quality that, you know, we should develop, you know, in giving classes or in, you know, talking to people about Krishna consciousness. It's a very good thing. And therefore, you know, you see that, you know, I don't want to mention any names, but, you know, like the Narayan Maharaj, that, you know, people come to his movements, and the big attraction is that they will get straight away, without showing the least qualification, they're able to access, you know, instructions on the leader of Radha and Krishna, and you know, so many things, and you know, they don't have to chant, you know, or if they chant, they chant, you know, they don't chant 16 rounds, they don't have to follow principles, they don't have to do regular service and deity worship, they don't have to, you know, regularly study, they can just come along and be the most insincere person whose qualifications haven't been tested at all, and there are just very intimate discussions on the philosophy of Krishna consciousness which should just not be taking place. So that's not a good example. That's, you know, Prabhupada was very careful. So, you know, we see that in Prabhupada's teaching. People criticize him for it, but actually he's actually preaching perfectly according to the mood of the Bhagavatam. The ones that should be criticized are the ones that are just freely giving, you know, information which is far, you know, beyond what such sometimes rascals should be hearing. Even what to speak of Srimad Bhagavatam as an astrologer, even in the Hara Shastra, which is Parasaramuni's, you know, it's like the Bible of astrology, you know, it's the standard instructions, the standard textbook. He says there, you cannot instruct even a person in astrology who doesn't have very similar qualities as mentioned here, you know, if they're you know, if they're not known to you, you shouldn't give them proper instructions astrologically. You know, if any of that activity they are known to you and there's any rascalism about them, you should not give them, you know. I'm very careful, you know, that's why I like to, you know, do, you know, help devotees with some astrological. I'm very hesitant with non-devotees because not all of them, but, you know, some of them I'll instruct, but I have to try and understand, you know, usually you can look at their chart. That's a good thing about being Australian, you look at the chart and you say, oh, I don't trust this person. You know, one time I was, when I was living down in Red Hill, and a lady came to me, she was married, to they'd moved out from Holland, and she said, I want you to do my chart, my husband's chart. And I said, well, I don't want to do, you know, your husband's chart unless I have his permission. So I did her chart, and I thought, oh, you know, you've got some major problems here, and you know, I tried to tell her as well as I could that her husband was probably one of the biggest rascals on earth. But I sort of mentioned, I think your husband sort of, you know, not being straightforward with you. I was trying. So I sort of had a look at his chart just to confirm it. Anyway, she wanted me to do it, and she got his permission. She wanted me to do the chart and give it to him for his birthday, and I said, I won't do a reading for him, but I'll tell you some of the things I see, and it won't be recorded. I said to him that her husband was probably cheating with numerous women, and that he would probably take everything from her, and which he did. Yeah. They'd actually moved out from Holland, and what he'd done is, in order to move, he told her that they had to put all their property in his name, which was, you know, like, he was about a millionaire. He was a dealer in gems or what have you. So they rented this place, and then she questioned him, understood he was seeing other people, and then basically, you know, he left. He left, went to some other part of Australia and was going back. And after he left, he just sold everything because it was all in his name. And she lost a lot, everything. The children, left the children with her, and she was left with nothing, not a penny to her name. He'd actually just completely cheated for many, many, many years. But, you know, for me to give him an astrology reading to assist him, you know, in his plans, you see what I mean? But the thing is, that's what I'm saying, you can actually look in their charts sometimes and you can see, well, I'm not giving you any advice, you know, because you're actually just helping me. So, you know, similarly, you know, we have to be very careful who we empower as a devotee, you know, who we're happy to raise up to a pedestal, you know. There has to be some, you know, even from the very beginning, when devotees are giving instruction, they should always be giving instruction, metering it out, you know, over a period as they get to know the person more and more, and their qualities, their sincerity, their lack of enviousness. These things should be there from the very beginning in their preaching. So. All right, so we've pretty much covered that. All right, so one chapter to go.
So this is of course when you are helping new devotees out, people check before the gospel offer.
Sorry? Yeah, look, when we speak in Krishna consciousness, we should just always be very careful to, you know, we sort of start from the bottom of our preaching in one sense, and we sort of work up, and we have to examine the audience to some degree. And, you know, if, for instance, sometimes in the Bhagavad Gita class you're actually speaking to people in general, you have to be a little careful, but sometimes because of the verse and the contents, like we did the 10th canto, you actually have to explain the thing. But if you detect that some of the people who are coming there are of dubious, you know, character, that you feel it's offensive you're speaking that, then you should just not do it. So you have to be a little careful.
But
this is
not
going
to
fall in the last class. Well, they might punch you in the face. We have to be aware it's there, but these things are usually left up to the discretion. That's why at every step in Krishna consciousness we should be actually seeking guidance. You know, at every step of Krishna we're always seeking guidance, because there's many, many things that can go wrong, there's many pitfalls. Devotees who very quickly join the movement and just will not take sufficient guidance except from a few people who literally condone even their nonsense, that's not a good sign. You know, devotees should always be taking guidance in most of the important things they're doing as a devotee. You know, what they're saying, how they're giving classes, how they're preaching, you know, everything. You know, and when devotees are reluctant to take that guidance, that's not a good sign. That, you know, they want to be independent, just feel that, you know, there's just one or two people you know, that they'll associate with, and those people tend to just condone a lot of nonsense. That's not a good sign. All right then, thank you very much. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. And once again we'll do that.
2 weeks,
next week there's David Meeta Swami's, he's holding David Meeta Swami's Vyasa Puja.
Oh.
So that's probably be quite a big event here.
Do you have to meet
Sunday at the exam, or... No, 2 weeks time to do last check.
Last check.